final speaker in this panel is Ruken Şengül, currently a Manoogian postdoctoral fellow at the University of Michigan and recent PhD graduate in anthropology from the University of Texas at Austin. Her primary research focuses on the interrelation of Armenian and Kurdish issues in the construction of Turkish state sovereignty in the eastern border region and on Kurdish identity politics in Diyarbakir. Her topic is Traversals, Time, History, and Justice in a Kurdish Diyarbakir.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks to the organizers. Thanks especially to Sabiha Sanyan for the event and for inviting me. I'm really not sure if I'm just so unlucky to be coming after Anush, especially, but also after Hagop. You'll find many overlaps between this presentation and theirs, but perhaps also sort of a different emphasis. So my focus will be on the ways in which Armenian past, variously inscribed local negotiations of identity, community, history, and space in the present-day Diyarbakir. I assume virtually everyone knows about Diyarbakir here. Soon after serving as the infamous city of death in 1915, the city became a strategic target of Turkish Republican policies of Turkifying history, space, and the Kurds. Beginning with the 1960s, it was a main hub of Kurdish political mobilization against the Turkish state, and by the end of the 20th century, it turned into the epicenter of the contested land of Turkish Kurdistan. Though, as some of you might also know, Diyarbakir today, especially since the turn of the 2000s, is at the same time a key site of Armenian-identified public activisms within Turkey's official borders. The rise of the sensitivity towards Diyarbakir's Armenian past has been intimately bound with the city's political Kurdification, especially since the 1980s, as Anush actually told, and as I shall detail shortly. Yet the particular forms, discourses, and activities through which this sensitivity is expressed today is inscribed in public space and speech has also a lot to do with other disjunctive processes that have been specifically shaded in the post-2000s. These processes include Turkey's EU candidacy, the introduction of multiculturalism in the language and politics of dissent, local repercussions of the rise of Ottoman nostalgia in metropolitan Turkey, and the development of Armenian counterpublics in here. And not the least, the memory return that accompanied the paradigm of transitional justice and reconciliation vis-a-vis the debates over the past and the present, both the Turkish and the Kurdish past and the present. So in effect, Diyarbakir hosts today a dynamic, crowded landscape of actors who seek to uncover, recover, or to use the concept within which this activism is most often framed to remember the Armenian past of Diyarbakir. We have on the one hand Kurdish local governments and activists who seek to promote awareness of Armenians and their destruction with a variety of activities that range from making official apologies. I'm not going to detail on the images, just to save on time. Or making official apologies for the Kurds' role in the genocide and undertaking cultural reconstruction projects in the varied forms of built heritage development. This is an image of the Sur Gregos Church, which is widely known, I think, also in here. And this is the Common Conscious Monument that was instituted in the year 2013 by the Kurdish local governments. On the epigraph it says, "We shared the pain so that they're not suffered again," in Kurdish, Turkish, English, Armenian, Arabic, and Hebrew. We have researchers and activists from metropolitan Turkey and abroad. These local governments sponsor also activists and scholarly meetings, and then we have researchers and activists from metropolitan Turkey and abroad to attend these meetings. But we have also culture brokers, entrepreneurs, fellow travelers who seek to recreate and experience an Armenian Diyarbakir in the present day by organizing various festive events, touristic pilgrimages, by creating themed spaces of culture and leisure, such as Armenian themed cafes that serve even dolma and baklava. Now, the emphasis that even here should be taken as ironic, because there's nothing exotic about serving baklava and dolma in Diyarbakir to put an Armenian shade on any space, because everyone in Diyarbakir already eat baklava and dolma. Last but not the least, there is also a new genre of urban writing in this commemorative field, concocted by a small yet influential class of Diyarbakir urban male literati, who seek to reanimate the city's Armenian past, enfolding it within a narrative of cosmopolitanism's past. Eventually, the city of that of a century ago becomes one center to revive the Armenians, or is being remembered with Armenians in their physical absence. Acts of remembrance, as has been frequently noted, are not mere recountings of individual or group experiences with or vis-a-vis another person, thing, time, or place. Rather, they are already mediated, interpretive public gestures of identification that tell more about individuals and groups' images of themselves in the present with the concerns of the present than about the past or the objects of remembrance. It has also been variously noted how the remembrance of things past builds upon and feeds into a feeling of absence, which is also a source of desire toward that thing. Thus, absence is not simply an antonym for presence, but a phenomenological perception of non-presence in terms of some loss or lack. Thus, the current scene of remembering the Armenians in Diyarbakir do not simply derive from what happened to the Armenians of Diyarbakir in 1915, as they are irreducibly shaped by a plethora of concerns, interests, and needs and desires that render the historical past relevant to the contradiction and conflicts of a Kurdish Diyarbakir in the present. Yet what it really means to describe a space with an ethnic label, or what really makes these narratives, Kurdish narratives. Unless one subscribes to an essentialist notion of identity, we know that the iterations of every collective identity, be it ethnicity, nation, class, or woman, involve an inescapable political moment. So are articulations of Kurdishness, including mine here, are political articulations that fills in the content and substance of what it seeks to describe in highly performative and contingent ways. In the rest of my time, I'll do two things. First, I'll historicize this vivid scene of Armenian identified activism in Diyarbakir vis-a-vis the development of Kurdish nationalism in the city, the rise of Kurdish political Kurdishness as an idiom of self-identification over a process of struggle against the Turkish state. I'll then contextualize the two post-2000s scene of remembering the Armenians, not as simply in a relationship of continuity with prior histories of violence and struggle, in which Kurdishness came to be imagined in relation to Armenians and Armenianness, but also as a point of rupture in the imaginations and representations of Diyarbakir, Kurdishness, and Armenians in relation to one another across history and the present. This happened thanks to the introduction of two novel discursive frameworks, namely multiculturalism and memory or remembering. So reviewing the pre-2000 narratives, my interest would be on understanding how these Kurdish narratives on Armenians. My interest would be on understanding. Is it better? Okay. How these Kurdish narratives traverse from transmitting knowledges of the historical event, the genocide, into transmitting notions of temporality, the unfolding of historical time and ethical action, and how they realize historicity and justice through narrative activity. This will form the basis of my description of the notions of history and the presence and time and justice that differentially inform the post-2000 urban scene of Armenian identified activism in Diyarbakir. Building upon this, I shall end with a brief critical engagement with the notion of transitional justice. I hope to be able to show how this connects this context relates, connects to this concept, which increasingly circumscribed debates over the Armenian genocide in Diyarbakir and other episodes of mass violence elsewhere, asking if these former narratives might open up venues to imagine history and justice beyond the founding tropes of the transnational justice regime. Okay, let me go on then with Kurdish narratives, the genealogies of Kurdish narratives on Armenians. Insofar as Kurdish knowledges and attitudes toward the genocide is concerned, one first needs to point out that we are speaking about a phenomena that radically differs from the politics of silencing and erasure, which have characterized not only the Turkish state policy or constructions of Turkishness, but also the interventions sought by much of the literature on genocide, especially those literatures that are concerned with genocide recognition. This is not only because, despite the systematicity of foreclosures imposed upon history, space, and collective identities, memories, the traces of Armenians could not, of course, be totally erased from local space, language, or memory, in what was a largely overlapping homeland for the Armenians and Kurds. It is also because political Kurdishness has been quite vocal about the Armenians since the formative process of Kurdish nationalism. For instance, in 1898, the first issues of the pioneering Kurdistan Journal came out with several editorials on the Armenian question, quote-unquote Armenian question, that sought to deter the Hamidian cavalries and ordinary Kurds from taking part in the killing of Armenians in the name of humanity, civilization, and nation, while charging Armenian nationalist revolutionaries with conspiring with the Ottoman Porte or the imperial powers for establishing an Armenian state in Kurdistan. From the First World War until the end of 1930s, there were quite several attempts at building Kurdish-Armenian political alliances, the last example of which was the Syrian diasporic organization of Hoybun, which played a critical role in the protracted Ararat rebellion of the 1930s. The Second World War brought search for joint political action to a halt, however. The new generations of Kurdish nationalist elites who sought continued to seek for accounting for the Kurds' role in the genocide by drawing upon temporally situated ideological epistemological frameworks of struggle, of national identity and struggle, such as feudalism, sociocultural backwardness of the Kurds, or the problem of Turkish colonialism and Kurdish comparator alliance. It helped throughout this process of self-reflection that the post-republican Kurdish nationalism in Turkey depended on its knowledge of national identity and history on the Kurdology canon of Soviet Russia, among whose practitioners were several quite influential Armenian researchers. Still under the 1980s, Kurdish nationalism was quite an elite ideology in Diyarbakir, with little bearing on ordinary people's self-identifications and their self-perceptions vis-à-vis the Armenians. And the specialized remains of Armenians were arguably too diffuse to inspire collective experiences of self, time, and space. The crucial point of rupture came with the 1980s, with the development of Kurdish nationalism into a popular movement under the lead of Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, as Anush neatly described. There were two opposing factors here. One was the role of the PKK, who recognized the destruction of Ottoman Armenians as genocide in 1980. As a result of various contacts with Asala, remember this was the just the 1970s, another world historical conjuncture when these two organizations were working in Baka alongside Al Fatih, and articulated new knowledges of Armenians and Kurdishness in the history of this event for the Kurdish masses by drawing upon frameworks of imperialism, anti-colonialism, internationalism, and the like. No less effective was the discourses and means by which the Kurdish-Turkish state sought to manage this dissent by systematically misnaming the PKK as Armenian terrorism. Anish said enough about that. I'll just say it and stop. This misnaming of the PKK as Armenian terrorism, though, deeply shaped the topography of counter-guerrilla warfare in Diyarbakir until the 1990s. However, it proliferated some of the most arbitrary forms of state violence. However, the same misnaming practice also so thoroughly backfired or miscarried among political Kurdish communities, who, weaving between the PKK's discourse, revolutionary discourse, and the state's violence scapegoating, came to imagine Armenians as their fate mates in oppression and comrades in resistance, or even as their own within what I call a terrorizing space of intimacy. I have to rely on okay, I have to say this. So I'll just read a narrative that I collected in 2007 as an example. I was interviewing Songül, then a Diyarbakir Kurdish woman in her 50s, about the murder of her brother Sadık in the city by the Turkish counter guerrilla, and she told, "I heard shootings after the morning prayer and rushed down the stairs, lamenting whose mother's home has collapsed onto her head this time. How could I know that this time it was my mother's home? There lying on the street was Mala Sadık. Ali, Yusuf, Hussein were there. We took a cab and took him to the hospital. The doctor said he had died on the spot. As we were putting him back into the cab, the police encircled us. They started beating the men with truncheons and Kalashnikov butts while shouting, 'Hit them, the Armenian, hit them, the Armenian.' I didn't know anything about the Turkish state policy. I didn't know what Kurdishness meant either. I had learned something about Kurdishness after I started visiting my family more frequently, but really I was going there to escape my father-in-law's pressures. When the police shouted like that, I lost my temper. I shouted back, throwing fists at one of them. 'How dare you call my brother an Armenian? Don't you know that he is the imam of the Nebi Mosque? How dare you call a man of religion an Armenian?' They started beating me as well. They did me so hard that I blacked out. There I understood being Armenian meant that you could be killed without remorse. There I understood Kurd meant Armenian. It was true then. We were Armenian. I think this narrative illustrates well how ordinary, non-politically invested or aware Kurds, in this case an ordinary woman who perceived the name of Armenian as an insult in her traditional habitus through her identification as Muslim, came to radically re-comprehend the meaning of Armenian in the process of making sense of her own Kurdishness in the 1990s. But what happens is highly unpredictable when one's Pandora's box opens. In the same terrorizing space of intimacy, which linked the Kurds to their Armenians as fate mates and comrades, they're proliferated in Kurdish intimate circles in Diyarbakir, also other narratives that reapprehended the past violence done against the Armenians, particularly the role that the Kurds play in the genocide, as explanatory reasons for why the Kurds were going through what they were. I'll just skip that. So driving these narratives were not any modern historicist logic, including the revolutionary pedagogy of the PKK, but culturally available knowledges and myths of how time works and moral agency operates, especially how time unfolds towards the restoration of justice. I'll just give one example because I'm out of time. From 1998, quite before I got interested in the affiliated genealogies of Armenian and Kurdish questions, I was working in a human rights advocacy campaign run on behalf of Kurdish populations displaced from the countryside in the 1990s as a strategy of counterinsurgency. That day, I was taking the testimony of Dazur about the burning and evacuation of her village Rez in the town of Lice in Diyarbakir in 1993. She suddenly relapsed back to 1925, the year when she had lived through the burning of Rez for the first time I saw it. And also the killing of her husband and brother and two brothers-in-law. All that had happened during the repression of the Kurdish Shahsaid rebellion in 1925. Recalling the event, she said, "My father-in-law was a wise man. Even before the mutiny of Shah Said, he used to say, 'Never disturb a bird's nest, it bodes no good. No bird finds rest in another's blighted nest.' Rus belonged to the Armenians. Many villages in the Mistan Highlands were theirs before. Our people moved to Rus after Ferman Afla, the imperial edict against the Armenians, 1915. Many Kurds had joined the killings then. For what? Islam? A plot of land? A single golden tooth? But once Ferman Afla was over, came Ferman Akurda, the edict against the Kurds. Don't forget, my daughter, divine retribution does not wait for the day of judgment. Kasas nahe kıyameti. This was never meant to be a home for us. We have been reaping the anguish that we have sown. I'll just end briefly with, you know, with an interpretation of this narrative and skip the whole part, which would have enabled this presentation to make sense, but whatever. Notice how in this narrative, the linking of Ferman Akurda to Ferman Afla through the archetypal myth or the pre-generic plot structure of divine retribution construct the Kurdish deeds in 1915 as a breach of moral agency, sin from which the totality of ex post factum experiences of Kurdishness has supposedly derived. Notice how in this messianic emplotment, the naif time of Ferman Akurda appears as at once stretched out and contracted time. Stretched out because it encompasses the chronological interval that unfolds since Ferman Afla. Contracted because since Ferman Afla, the chronological time unravels as the beginning of the end. Thus, the Kurdish present conjures as the time that remains from 1915 towards the restoration of justice. I should have managed time better. But if you wanna ask in what sense the 2000s was a point of rupture, I'll be more than happy to answer during the Q&A.